From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is a special hour of Radio Boston. Today, we're bringing you some of our favorite stories about triumph over adversity. From a man who turned a prison sentence into a college degree.
Education becomes a lifeline for us, and we hold on to it with all our heart. And that's the only thing that gives us hope in a place that is hopeless.
And a Harvard professor reckoning with the roots of crime and mass incarceration as she mourns her cousin's death.
His life changed inexorably that day when he was 15 and he tried to take somebody's car with a gun. Inexorably and irreversibly.
To a young Muslim boy from a conservative family who dreams of being a fashion designer.
I found a way to make sure that I could do it without being scolded for it. So I just didn't tell them. I decided to go to fashion college and they thought that I was going to college for psychology.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We were so happy to welcome you to our table for Thanksgiving to talk about the bonds of food and family. Today, we invite you to turn your thoughts and ears to stories of triumph over adversity. During this pandemic, adversity has been our collective experience. Let's meet and be inspired by people who faced it and overcome it. From a man who stayed up late nights in prison so he could get a college degree, to a gay Muslim boy in South Yorkshire, England, who grew up to be a global fashion icon. We begin with a maximum security prison, where Sebastian Yoon was sentenced at 16 years old for manslaughter after a bar fight. In prison, he began a journey to redemption and freedom, and what got him there was studying. Sebastian Yoon visited us in Studio 3 last year, along with filmmaker Lynn Novick, whose documentary, College Behind Bars, tells his story and caught the attention of many, including New England patriot Devin McCourty, who went on to promote it. Sebastian began by telling us why he decided to pursue a college degree through the Bard Prison Initiative.
I applied because, well, first, I was 21 years old, and I was having conversations with my friends who were on the outside. And they were in college, and they would talk to me about GPA and their courses while they were in the visiting room with me, and I would feel totally lost, and I would say, you know, I'm supposed to be out there going to college with you guys, and here I am sitting in prison just waiting for the day to end so that I could see the next. And this was going to be a repetitive thing until I get released 12 and a half years later.
You were incarcerated at age 16,
yes.
Right? So this was 5 years
into. This was 5 years into my thing.
So here is Max Kenner. He's the founder and executive director of BPI, and he's talking about how the inmates are treated as regular Bard students.
Mm-hmm.
When that door closes, you're at Bard College. Faculty are going to be evaluating what you do as a student exclusively. That is to say, the college has no interest in the nature of your criminal conviction, the length of your sentence, how much time you have left in prison. It's not our business. We're in the business of education. This is the thing we know how to do, and we happen to do it here.
Okay, so that was intimidating to me, just listening to him when I was watching the documentary. So your classes happened in a school setting, but the reality is that anytime you weren't in the classroom, you were in prison. And
yes.
Even when you were in the classroom,
right.
You were in prison. You didn't have the resources that a traditional school setting would have, the environment. The word that kept coming up over and over was the environment is chaos.
Right.
So what challenges did that present for you?
The biggest challenge for me was catching a ticket, whether it was something I was guilty of or not. You can be,
what does that mean, catching
so,
a ticket?
So, for example, you can have a ticket for, you can get a ticket for having over 10 books in your cell because it's a fire hazard. But throughout our courses, we could have one course that gives us 10 books. So how do we navigate this? And I had my peers who actually got tickets because they had more than 10 books in their cells.
What happens when you catch a ticket?
You can get key blocked, which is like punishment. You can't come out of your cell. And then the worst one is when you're sent to SHU, which stands for Special Housing Unit, and you're locked in for 23 hours a day for like 30, 60, 90 days.
We had a chance to talk with Patriot Safety Devin McCourty.
Mm.
And when we asked him, had he seen parts of the documentary and how did he feel about them, one of the things he specifically spoke about was being struck by a prisoner who was studying, who would study at 2 or 3 in the morning when they could really focus. That was you. That was you. So how does it feel to know that your dedication to your goal, your endeavor, was inspiring not only in your context, but this is an NFL player,
right.
The height of dedication to his profession.
Right.
Were you that kind of serious about your studies?
I certainly was, but what's the thing with this documentary is that you only see a handful of us. If you only met all the other BPI students, they all do the same thing. I mean, if you look at the film, you could see the dark bags under our eyes, and that's from lack of sleep, because we really work so hard, because I've said this before, but education becomes a lifeline for us, and we hold on to it with all our heart, and that's the only thing that gives us hope in a place that is hopeless.
So that raises this question of motivation, Sebastian. Mm. Where was the urgency coming from for you?
Going to prison at the age of 16 was very difficult, and I struggled to find a reason to continue to live in prison. And I spent most of my days just staring at the ceiling, thinking about what life would be like upon being released, and everything seemed so bleak and empty, and I wanted to put color into that world, and I found it through education.
Lynn, we hear, Sebastian, in your voice, the pain of those early years and the isolation. There's a lot of the prison experience that you either don't or can't tell in the documentary. What did you not tell, and why?
You know, I think in listening to Sebastian, the thing that came to mind for me that was revelatory that I didn't understand, among many things I didn't know, was the sense of the isolation and loneliness in prison. And, you know, the stereotypes are that it's violent and scary and dangerous, but actually the dehumanizing that happens from the second you're involved in the criminal justice system is magnified and magnified. And so I was very surprised to learn from the acting commissioner of Department of Corrections in New York, Anthony Annucci. He said, my biggest problem is suicide in prison. That's a huge problem. And that speaks to the lack of hope that Sebastian's referring to. So trying to represent that, I think that was really important. Just try, how do you show loneliness? How do you show alienation and disappointment and all of that? And I think, you know, that I think just trying to get that feeling across, I'm not sure we could succeed, but that's, we definitely tried to do that in contrast to what the BPI students are experiencing.
You also juxtapose some of the other kinds of jobs that are available to inmates if they're not able to study in BPI: janitorial work, manual labor. Sebastian, how did it feel to be among inmates who weren't having the same opportunities that you were? And are there other ways to help inmates find hope and purpose? Mm-hmm. Or is this really that rare and exclusive an opportunity?
Well, we as soon as we become Bard College students, we become proponents of education. We change the very atmosphere of the prison in which we are staying at. You'll notice that every time the entrance exam comes around in the summertime, about 2-3 months prior, we start going to the yard and we start having discussions with others, telling them, hey, the entrance exam is coming in 3 months. Do you want to study up? And then you'll actually see inmates in the yard, both BPR students and non-BPR students, seeing and reading books and going over grammar and writing.
So we do have to talk about crime. This is a college program that happens in a prison environment. Sebastian, you say in the documentary that you were incarcerated because you got into a fight and someone died. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel tension between your crime and the fact that you got a college degree, mm-hmm. essentially as a result of right. that crime?
I don't want to say that I got as a result of my crime. It's just that I got it in spite of my crime. I was in a situation where I went to prison for that crime, and I took the best opportunity that I could in order to rectify the past wrongs in the best way I can.
How did your education change your understanding of where you'd come from and the reason you were in prison?
Well, education provided me the opportunity for a lot of self-reflection and kind of get over my insecurities and acknowledge my insecurities. When I was a teenager, I recognized that I wanted to feel loved and I wanted power because I felt weak. I was a victim of bullying and I went to the streets and that's where I found power. And going to prison, I lost everything. And I was just reduced to just a shell of a human being. And education, like I said again, was the only thing that I could hold on to.
The BPI is not without controversy, especially around funding. There's a lot of debate over whether public funds should be used to provide college education to inmates, mm-hmm. Whether this benefit should even exist. Sebastian, what's your reaction to that?
Here's the economical argument. So there are over 2.1 million inmates across the United States in prison and jails. For every dollar that we spend on education today, we would save $4 to $5 every year. Let me also add the recidivism rate. Nationally, it's 67% within the first 5 years. For BPI students, it's less than 5%.
One of the things that is striking about the documentary is the way that people inside the prison begin to understand their relationship with the community outside mm-hmm. the prison. How did you set out to tell that story, or did that part tell itself?
It does become a theme of the film, and it, I think, challenges all of us to ask the same question Sebastian was saying about, you know, what is prison for? who has access to education? And what are we as citizens demanding of our leaders who have these put these systems in place that are totally broken? But we also tell a different story now, which is we've seen change, and we built that in over time, that in 2016, the Obama administration reinstituted a small sort of experimental version of Pell Grants and made college available to 12,000 people who weren't having it before across the country. And the Trump administration is actually expanding that program. So I think we're seeing a more common sense criminal justice reform conversation and understanding that education has to be at the core of anything that's going to be meaningful.
I want to talk about your father for a minute, Sebastian. You gave a speech at your commencement, and during that speech, you apologized to your dad. Here's some of that.
My dad. Papa, I'm sorry for having dishonored our family. For putting you through such undeserved and unbearable pain. Papa, 사랑합니다. Thank you. Congratulations.
Your father was there. What was it like to be able to share that accomplishment with him and give him that message?
Having raised me by himself, that man has loved me tremendously, and I felt like by coming to prison, I've hurt the only person that really truly loved me. And that moment was for me to say, here's the beginning of my redemption. Here's my moment to become a son who can make you proud. And that was the highlight of my PPI career, to have spoken that message to my dad and to have received that degree. And my dad, from that day on, he was so happy, and he would actually brag to his buddies that my son, you know, despite being in prison, has obtained a college degree.
You also talk about, in the documentary, you talk about being on a high from graduation, but then right after the ceremony, you have this realization.
You have this big smile on your face when you're leaving the auditorium and the mess hall, and you see this room, and then all of a sudden, reality just comes crashing upon you. And then you say, oh, this is my reality. But I thought what just happened in the auditorium was also reality. So you have this problem where you have to try to juggle these two realities, one of which is so beautiful and one of which is so dark and disgusting.
What's your reality now?
My reality is I'm just looking forward. I think in prison, all we did in the prior to BPI is think about what I should have done and could have done. And after BPI, it was about what should I do in spite of my past.
Lynn, do you think about and do you worry about the BPI graduates who still have time to serve when they've completed their degrees?
I mean, that is one of the unusual aspects of this particular college program, that not every student who graduates leaves campus, and there are people who are still there, sometimes for many years and sometimes for a shorter amount of time. But I think what's wonderful is that the program gives them the opportunity to keep taking classes. You can even have a whole other major sometimes, and, you know, a whole new course of study, and also sort of mentor the students coming in. And so I think it's given everybody, they would say, an opportunity to find purpose, even in a place where that's very hard to do. And luckily, I think the parole system in New York State anyway is evolving so that people are getting released when they're up for parole more often than they used to. So there's more hope for that. But it is hard, for sure, that you could graduate and still be there.
Sebastian, you're going to do events with community, but also with communities, excuse mm-hmm. me, but also in prisons around the film. What do you hope those who are still incarcerated but will see this documentary, what do you hope they'll take away?
See that they could be in the same position as we are, who are in social reform work, that you don't have to come home and think that your ceiling is working somewhere at like Walmart. Like, that's what I used to think, that when I come home, I can't do any serious jobs. I'm not putting down anybody that works there, but there's that notion that if you come out of prison, you're going to be sweeping floors. You're going to be mopping floors. You're going to be putting stocks on the cabinets. You can do something more. You can become somebody.
That was Sebastian Yoon with filmmaker Lynn Novick. They visited us in Studio 3 last year after the release of their documentary, College Behind Bars. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to this special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're bringing you stories of triumph over adversity this hour, stories to lift our spirits. Before the break, we heard from Sebastian Yoon, who found redemption in a college degree and is now inspiring others to do the same. Now, let's meet author and Harvard professor Danielle Allen. Prison was also a central feature in her young adulthood, as she often would visit her cousin Michael there. Michael was arrested for the first time when he was just 15 and spent his formative years in prison. Professor Allen's 2017 book, Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A., reflects on Danielle's journey through the Ivy League to a fast-rising academic career while Michael lived for several years of incarceration. Professor Allen's 2017 book, Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A., reflects on Danielle's journey through the Ivy League to a fast-rising academic career while Michael lived through several years of incarceration and then died violently in 2009 at the age of 29. Their diverging paths reveal something deep not only about mass incarceration in America, but forgiveness, understanding, and grace after tragedy. The book was named one of the best of the year by the Washington Post and San Francisco Chronicle. Danielle Allen spoke to Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty shortly after her book was published. She began by highlighting when her life and her cousin Michael's began to split apart.
I mean, there is a way in which it's a big American story because my dad and his sister Karen grew up on this tiny island off the coast of northern Florida, southern, you know, African-American fishing community. And my dad ended up in Claremont, California as a college professor. Karen ended up in Los Angeles as a single mother, having left an abusive relationship, and worked her way up as a nurse. But so we had a, you know, I grew up as a faculty brat in a college town. Michael was growing up in the city, but they spent a lot of time with us. They lived with us sometimes. The real shock in Michael's life came when he was 10, his mother met somebody and thought she had the prospect of a happy life, a marriage, stability, and so forth. And it was just the most tragic decision. The person she married turned out to be violent. Mm-hmm. The family moved 5 times in 5 years. Michael was changing school constantly. And that was exactly the same time. So I was going off to Princeton. So that's sort of when they diverged, was when his life got caught up in this terrible marriage of his mother's. And I was headed off to liberal arts education in beautiful surroundings.
Yeah. You call him, like, he's little Michael. He's like your little brother. Mm-hmm. And in that difficult time, he's just a kid, right?
Exactly. I mean, so they were back in Southern California. And that was the years between 1992 and 1995 when everything was happening. I mean, they're basically the peak of violent crime in Southern California at that point in time. And at that point, Michael was this free-floating agent. He didn't have a community. He didn't have a world. And I think landed in the middle of an incredibly difficult, rough Los Angeles. And it's exactly when all the pieces of Michael's life sort of gave way.
If we could, I mean, because I think people need to know, can we talk about the circumstances of his arrest when he was 15?
Sure.
Right? Because he had a gun.
Yes. So it was a Sunday morning in September 1995, and Michael had a gun. He'd acquired it a couple of weeks earlier. We don't know exactly how. He came upon a guy, 44-year-old guy, cleaning a Cadillac. And, you know, Michael came up, told him to hand over his watch. Guy did. Wallet. Guy did. It was empty. Michael threw it back and said, "I'm taking the car." And then his victim lunged for him. Michael had his gun pointed at the ground the entire time. That was one of the details that the victim told the police. So the victim lunged for the gun, got it, and shot Michael through the neck. And that was the end of his attempted carjacking. It turned out, so then, you know, the police came, ambulance came, they took Michael to the hospital. And on the way there, he both confessed to what he'd just done, but he also told the police that he had also robbed 2 people the previous day in the same block, and or 3 people rather, and 1 person a week earlier. There was this time, something was going on. It was a spree. You have to say that about that week. It came out of nowhere. That is, there hadn't been anything like that in his experience before then. He had never been a violent person. So mm-hmm. it was a very surprising episode.
But this is a moment in which context is so important here, right? Because as you analyze in the book, California had its three strikes law.
Right, which was brand new. I mean, that's right. It was like 18 months old. This was the big thing.
And there was extreme public attention and interest around carjacking in Southern California. In that great sweep, he goes from not having a criminal record to facing potentially life in prison.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's it.
Based on what happened on that one day.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the judge told him that, you know, he had to make a decision about his plea. Was he going to plead guilty or stand trial? And so what the judge said was, you know, if you stand trial and you're convicted on all four of these, that will trigger the no strikes law. And that'll be 25 years to life that you're facing in sentencing. So being presented with what looked like a sort of 25 year to life option on the one hand, since he'd already confessed to everything, or a plea deal, he took the plea deal.
Well, I mean, you write about how his mother, your aunt,
that's right,
prayed to find, to have an answer, which one to choose.
Yeah, Michael himself couldn't choose. He couldn't choose.
Well, 15-year-old could.
Yeah, so it was, and I think for my aunt, that was probably, you know, one of the most, if not the most painful moments in the whole experience. She said, you know, she went outside the courtroom and prayed and prayed and prayed some more, is how she tells the story. You know, God told her Michael would get 7 years, so she went ahead and said that they should accept the plea deal, and instead he got 13 years.
I just keep thinking about how all of this happened to Michael when he was 15. And by the time he's 17, he's sent to one of California's toughest adult prisons. It's there that we really hear from him. I guess what I mean to say is that in the book, we hear Michael's voice. Because you include a lot of the writing that he did in prison.
Very talented.
Extraordinarily talented. Yeah. Do you mind if I just read a couple of lines from one of the parts that you include? Because he is so aware of the significance of who he is in the eyes of the state.
That's right. Yes.
Once he becomes incarcerated.
Yes.
Right? He says, "We who are in prison had to answer for our sins, and our lives were taken from us. Our bodies became the property of the state of California. We are reduced to numbers and stripped of our identity. To the state of California, I am not Michael Alexander Allen, but I am K10033.
Yeah. You know, he was astute. He was smart. He could express the most complex emotions and give voice to experiences that are unimaginable for those of us who've never been inside a prison.
What did his writing reveal to you that you think you might have otherwise not known about what being in prison did to him?
Well, could I read a little bit more? Would that be okay?
Please.
That's probably the easiest way of doing
absolutely.
It. So let me just go ahead and read a little bit from his essay about Dante's Inferno. "My hell is no longer demonstrating what I am capable of doing in order to survive. It has become what I can tolerate and withstand in order to live. I cannot help but to judge those around me. I am one of them, but we are far from the same. Like Dante, I am cursed with a spirit of discernment, which allows us to see the truth for what it is. There are most whom I despise who are truly sick beyond healing, and they should never leave this place. Then there are those who await to fulfill their destiny. I see in them a sincere and apologetic heart for their ill misdeeds. They are the ones who will change the world positively, or positively change someone's world. Hell cannot hold the latter of the two opposites, but in time will only spit them back out into society to do what is right. The hell that I live in cannot hold Dante. Hell can test and try oneself, but it cannot hold Dante, and it will not hold me. In the inferno, the dead are trapped forever. Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out."
It's amazing.
You know, he was a really special guy, no question about it.
You know, I keep going back to the fact that when he first became incarcerated, he was so young.
Yeah.
Right? He was 15.
Right.
And you write about how, you know, for most teenagers, there are a series of milestones in your teenage years, you know, in the outside world. But there's an entirely different set of milestones that you suffer through in prison as a teenager.
So when he was 17, he was moved from the juvenile into the adult system, and he was moved to a prison at the Oregon border. I mean, it was so far away, his mother couldn't visit him. And, you know, other rituals are, you know, first administrative segregation, as it's called, which is a label for solitary confinement, first racial melee, first sodomization. It's, you know, it's when I was writing the book, one of the things that was very important to do was to try to juxtapose different teenage experiences, and in particular mine and my cousins, and to show the things that are similar about them: the loneliness, the insecurity, the first experiments with intimacy and relationships and things like that, the effort to carve out your own space, the desire for mobility and freedom and so forth. And then to show how, you know, this is a teenager going through all those experiences of an ordinary teenager, but in this cauldron of prison that is so violent and so full of brutality. And to then ask the question of, well, what does that mean? What kind of development can we expect for a young person in that sort of situation? It's just crazy to think.
I come back to how he ended that essay on Dante about him saying he has a way out.
Right.
Because it seems like ultimately, even though he did get out of prison, he didn't really have a way out.
No, exactly. Yeah, he didn't. No, his life changed inexorably that day when he was 15 and he tried to take somebody's car with a gun. But that's what you realize is when somebody's been in prison for 11 years and that's their social world and life, to ask them to start fresh is to ask them to give up every meaningful connection that has made their life bearable for the last 11 years. And that is a demand of surpassing difficulty.
But one of the things that happened to Michael, as you tell his story, is that, you know, as a young person, he's in prison during a time where, you know, the criminal justice system is incredibly punitive. A prison experience basically seeks to eradicate the humanity out of those people who've been incarcerated. But he falls in love,
too. He falls in love,
this incredibly human thing.
That's right, exactly.
And I can only begin to imagine the edges of the potency of that.
Right,
that in
exactly.
this place that's so devoid of humanity, there's this profound connection. And he takes that connection with him.
That's right, exactly. It's the connection that he can't renounce.
Yeah.
And that means he was deeply and permanently connected to a person he loved and who loved him, but who was also violent, and their relationship had violence in it, and it ended in his death.
And yeah, because it had unspeakable consequences afterwards.
Exactly.
And that is what dogged him, even though, to a certain degree, the support system that he had through you
right.
and your family
right.
after he got out of prison was highly unusual.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, he had this big family. It had people with financial resources, people with educational resources in it. You know, we had a lot of things to bring to bear on trying to help Michael. And really, you know, remarkably, within 6 weeks of his release in 2006, we had he was enrolled in school. He had a job and he'd been offered an apartment to live in. That was.
Can I just jump in here? I'm going to ask you to use I again, because you were a major part of this.
We did it together.
You know,
we were a team, the two of us. So, it was. Sorry. It's much easier not to use I. So, yes, I was with Michael's mother on his release day. And that was the beginning of summer of intense effort as we worked together to try to give him a foundation from which he could build something meaningful and valuable to him. He'd fought wildfires in California in prison, and he loved it. You know, that was, again, a sort of this bright spot, an opportunity for resilience and growth and something positive in the midst of the prison experience. And so he was going to work at Sears and go to a community college that would let him do a fire technology program. And he and I were spending every day together putting these pieces together.
I don't mean to dig deep in a way that causes pain. I really don't. But I think it's really important for people to hear some of these details. I really do. Because that's, if we don't know,
right,
what's going to change, nothing. Because
right,
you write so beautifully about what seem to be small details, but they're so vitally important in the process that, again, Michael and you,
right,
and the family tried to go through to get him back on his feet.
Right.
And that moment that you write about where you find the place,
mm-hmm,
that looks like it's a perfect place for him to live.
Right.
And you had to go and introduce yourself to the landlords.
Yep. I went first.
Yeah.
I went first.
But even more important, I thought, as a reader reading the story, was there's a line where you say, then Michael went and you had practice with him on how to tell his story.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
To the landlords.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, who wants to rent an apartment to somebody who's just gotten out of prison after 11 years for attempted carjacking? I mean, that's a pretty big ask. So you can't even, you know, can't kind of like just go into that without a lot of care and effort and so forth. So you have to find a good place and you have to be clear in your own mind. We had to be clear. I had to be clear. Michael had to be clear that it was right, that we could do right by the people who were there, that he could live well, that he could be in control of his life, that I could vouch for that. And so, yeah, it takes a lot of preparation to feel like ready to walk up to strangers and say, I can vouch for my cousin who's just been in prison for 11 years.
You and your family put so much effort into trying to rebuild his life. But his story is one where he could not get past the wounds and the consequences,
right,
of those wounds that he suffered while in prison. And he got killed.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, it's just, you know, at the time when he was thinking about whether to take this apartment, I could not understand his thinking, his choice. I could not see I had no idea what was going on. I could make no sense of it at all. All I knew is, you know, at the end of 24 hours, he decided firmly that he wasn't going to take the apartment. And then it wasn't until four or five months later when he called and said he was ready to take an apartment. And I went to go look at it with him. And he said that he and his girlfriend, Bree, were going to move into the apartment. Bree was his girlfriend whom he'd met in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So a transgender woman. They'd been lovers in prison. And I did not know that they were still seeing each other. They had reconnected after he got out. And I suddenly understood that that was what his decision-making was about that day when he couldn't take that apartment. It was a choice right then between Bree's world and the world he had had for the last 11 years. And with that choice in front of him, he chose the love of his life.
Yeah. The love of his life, the one person who gave him physical comfort and love in prison when he was just a teenager. But it was Bree who pulled him back into gangs and to running drugs. And Danielle, it was Bree, the love of his life, who shot and killed Michael in 2009.
That's right, exactly. Yeah.
What is the lesson from Michael's life for all of us?
You know, I've been trying to boil it down to just one lesson, and I just find it impossible to do. So I think, you know, I have a couple, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So one lesson is just that when kids are 10 to 14, they need every adult in their life to be talking to each other. Like, forget about shame. Forget about the conflicts that keep different family members from sharing things with each other. Every kid in that hard adolescent transition period needs just like total openness and frankness from adults with them, making it possible for them to be open and frank also. And my family, we didn't do that. And that's, I think, our responsibility in this story. And then another lesson is that we have really destroyed lives with the criminal justice system. And that's a combination of how we think about juvenile justice, how we think about mandatory minimums, and what we've done with the war on drugs, which is to build this incredible world of hypocrisy and sustain an incredibly powerful illegal black market. And we really underestimate its power and the general distorting effects it has on society and especially on youth experience. So I would put all these things together. And the last thing really about the question of, you know, Michael, what's Michael's responsibility? How do we think about that and so forth? I think Michael himself took responsibility for his choices, and his Dante essay makes that very clear. He understood he'd made the wrong choices, and he understood himself to have been motivated by, in his words, greed and lust in the moment when he tried to steal the car. And he knew that, and he changed, and he had a view about what was wrong with his own decision-making. But at the same time that he accepted personal responsibility for his own choices, I think as a society, we also have to accept responsibility for the fact that we present young people with vastly disparate degrees of difficulty on the life courses in front of them. And yes, even in the most difficult circumstances, some people can master the degree of difficulty and overcome, but many people can't. And when society is leaving young people in poverty, leaving young people without access to good education, we have to recognize that we are creating the patterns, the degrees of difficulty that they're obliged to confront.
That was author and Harvard professor Danielle Allen speaking to Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2017. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we've been bringing you stories of triumph over adversity. Sebastian Yoon found a future and redemption through earning a college degree in prison. Danielle Allen took the heartbreak of her cousin's life, cut too short by the cruelty of mass incarceration, and found understanding and beauty. Our last story is about a boy who also feels trapped by his community, his socioeconomic status, and attitudes about his identity. Tan France grew up on the rainy streets of Doncaster, England. He dreamed of being a fashion designer and overcame bullying to become one of the stars of Netflix's series, Queer Eye. France came by Studio 3 in June of 2019 to talk about his book, and he spoke to Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. France said he couldn't be the man he is today without the struggle of those early years.
My granddad owned a factory that created denim for Disney, and I learned to sew at a very young age. I wasn't working there, just to clarify. I would go and visit because I loved being there. The space was fantastic, and I learned to sew. And then when I decided on what career path I wanted to take, fashion was the only option for me. However, that because that wasn't really a thing in my community, I found a way to make sure that I could do it without being scolded for it. So I just didn't tell them. I decided to go to fashion college, and they thought that I was going to college for psychology until my graduation.
So the answer is to lie.
Yeah. You know, sometimes lying is the way.
So tell me about the first piece of clothing that you connected with, that you loved.
The first piece of clothing was a piece of clothing that I actually didn't own and that never existed. But it was a piece of clothing that I remember very distinctly. I wanted more than anything in the world. You know, when you were six Oh, remember when you were like 6, 7, 8, whatever? You wanted like toys for your birthday. What toy did you want for your birthday? Just do you remember roughly?
Honestly,
like Cabbage Patch Kids.
No, I wanted one of those Super Soaker things.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's the kind of thing that a 6 or 7 year old wants.
Yeah.
I did not want that.
What did you want?
I wanted a custom made black silk shirt. And I was obsessed with that. And I asked for it for my birthday for many years, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I never got it. So that's the first time I really remember thinking, clothes are clearly very significant to me if that's what I'm asking for my birthday.
Tan, I'd like to play a clip from season one, where you did a makeover of a man named Corey Waldrop in Georgia. He's a veteran, NASCAR fan, Trump supporter. And so perhaps just about the opposite of you.
No, that describes me perfectly.
And you had a touching moment where you were going through his closet with him and found a lot of his dad's clothes. Mm-hmm. So let's listen to that.
Why is it that you keep your dad's clothing in here?
I guess that's the way that I still connect with him. He loved my mom. He loved us.
Mm-hmm.
And just didn't get much better than him.
Mm-hmm.
Just an all-around great guy.
Can I give you a hug? Oh, I'm sorry, mate.
It's a very touching moment. Mm-hmm. What was going through your head in that moment?
That was only the second episode we ever filmed, so it was my second week on set. What was going through my head was I can't believe how vulnerable this man is willing to be with a complete stranger. That was the first hour that I met him, and he was willing to be so open with me. And I just thought, wow, what we're going to go through over the next few weeks as we film the show is going to be so impactful on my life. Hopefully there's two, but I just thought this is going to make me feel compassion like I've never known before.
Well, and that's sort of one of the central themes of the show, right? This idea of overcoming differences, showing that a gay British man of South Asian descent can have an intimate moment with a Trump voter in his closet.
Yeah.
Is that difficult?
No. I think for many it would be, but I am a South Asian man in what I was in England. I now live in the US, so now I'm an immigrant. Believe me, I've had a lifetime of training when it comes to people being somewhat negative towards me. And so I know how to combat that. I know how to approach that. I lead with kindness and tolerance and accept any question, no matter how disrespectful they may seem. I will accept those questions and answer them. I was trained my whole life for this.
Well, and you actually write about that in the book very beautifully about some of the incredibly racist way that people have treated you growing up and now, and the slurs and harassment, and especially after 9/11, the fact that you are routinely pulled aside in the airport for questioning.
Mm-hmm.
How have you come to terms with all of that, or have you?
I have. Again, it's all I've ever known. If that was all you ever knew, you'd find a way to accept it and move on. It's not great, and now I'm in a position to be able to call that behavior out. But it's something I found a way to reconcile. And so what I do is I understand how it makes me feel, and I know that I don't want anyone else to feel that way. So I speak out about it, and I will against it, and I will speak to the people who are throwing those assaults at me, that abuse at me, and ask them why they feel it's okay, what they think that I've done that would warrant such a reaction. It's a very uncomfortable conversation, and I don't think they're ever expecting me to confront them that way. I think they're used to people swearing at them. I know that that doesn't achieve anything, so I'd rather just say, I know that you think that the most common thing used to be, we pay for you to live. Like, my taxes pay for you. My reaction was always...
What does that even mean?
Well, because I was in their country, air quotes. You're here as an immigrant, and so therefore you must be taking advantage of our system. No, I had a job. My parents were in that country. They had many jobs to make sure that we were providing...
Well, and you say in the book very strongly, this is my country.
This is my country. I was born and raised in that country. The Brits colonized our country, and then I had therefore a right to be in the UK. And so when people are throwing that abuse at me, I very calmly give a rebuttal.
Tan, I also want to ask you about another thing you wrote in the book, it's in a couple of places. But early on, you say you don't want to be asked by interviewers about religion, and that it's a very personal thing for you. But then later on, you write about how important your representation is on TV mm-hmm. and that you, quote, hope that there comes a time when there is no need to talk about being queer or gay or Muslim. And so I guess my question, I was thinking this while reading, if we're not in that place where there's no need to talk about it, then why not talk about it?
Let me explain. In my opinion, there's no reason to talk about it. And I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few days. There's no real reason for me to break down who I am or what my community is all about. I think just by being visible, people know that I'm South Asian. You can see it. People now know that I'm Muslim. I've spoken about it enough, or just mentioned it enough. There's no reason to speak out more about it other than to just be. When you are a white man, I can't imagine that in any interview they'd say, "Hey, so you're white. Tell me about how that feels." There's no, you just are, you represent by just being. And that's how I feel about who I am at this point. I don't talk about the ins and outs of being gay anymore, really, other than I'm gay. I'm brown.
It just is.
It just is. That is just so.
But you also write in the book about growing up, you know, yearned to see people mm-hmm. like you reflected on television.
Yeah.
And now you're that person, yeah. perhaps for thousands or millions of people around the world. I mean,
and that's,
is that a heavy responsibility?
It is. It is. It really is. But the way I do it now in particular is just by being on the show. I don't talk about religion. On the show, I don't talk about my upbringing. I just am there. I am doing the same job as everybody else. And I love that it's just normalizing who we are, what we do. We are just the same as everybody else. I'm on a show that's a makeover show, that's a make better show, that was helping human connection. And so I don't belabor any of those points. It comes up in conversation because it's an important part of me, but that's not the only part of me. My sexuality, my religion, they're all secondary. First and foremost, I am a person, and I'm equal to my peers on the show. And so that's how I feel about my responsibility. Yes, I feel a responsibility to represent my community well, and therefore I try and make sure that I'm being the best version of myself that I can be, and that is how I'd represent.
You also write in the book about skin tone, color, race, and how at one point in your life you tried bleaching your skin. And I want to ask you about that. I mean, were you ashamed of who you were, or how did you become more comfortable in your own skin?
No, I want to make this really clear. It wasn't that I was ashamed of who I was. I was ashamed of myself that I tried bleaching my skin. I tried bleaching my skin because in my culture and in many cultures, especially in the Middle East, in South Asia, in Far East Asia, they are encouraged to be as light as physically possible, because the lighter you are, the more successful you will be, the more successful marriage you will, partner you will get for a successful marriage. It is ever present in our community. The fairer the skin, the more successful you will be. And I'd known that from the time I was born. And so that I succumbed to the pressure. And that's what I'm ashamed of. And now I feel relief that I did it for a few days. It hurt. No desire to ever do it again. And now I'm in a position where, thank God, I love my color. And I encourage people very often on my Instagram to embrace their color. If they're beautifully brown, they are beautifully brown.
So I want to ask you about another thing I noticed in the book. And I'm sorry if I might push your buttons here.
Go.
But, okay. So there are multiple places in the memoir where you write about folks who hurt you, who wronged you, mm-hmm. who were mean to you when you were a kid, mm-hmm. or said mean things to you in your DMs. And each time you kind of have a strong reaction back at them, you know, deleting their Facebook requests, and I will never, you know, basically calling them out.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm wondering why it was important for you to include those anecdotes in your memoir.
Because,
are you still hurting? Do you want to talk it out?
No, I'm not still hurting. The reason why I included that is because I want people to see that I am still very much a person. If I went on the show, if you went on the show and you had people from your old life who were wanting to be part of your life because you had just, let's say, for example, you won the lottery. They wanted to be a part of your life because
dream
you
about
won
it every day.
Lovely, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to be a part of your life. Would you really respond well to that? No, you'd be like, no, the reason why you want to now date me is because I just won the lottery. So I wanted this book to be very clear. I am still very much tan. And therefore, if somebody is ludicrous and they are crazy enough to send me a message to say, hey, we should hang out more, when they haven't contacted me in 15 years, I need them to know I'm still tan. Very much tan.
And you still hurt me then.
Yes.
Okay. We're rapidly running out of time, so I want to make sure we fit in a few things. You had no TV hosting experience before Queer Eye.
No.
And you're doing great.
Thank you.
But for all those folks out there listening who might have dreams of grandeur, what's your message to them?
Don't be desperate. That's how I got my job, because I didn't really think I needed it or wanted it. And then once you've got it, learn as much as you can as quickly as physically possible. I was trying to quit the job for the first few weeks because I thought that I sucked so hard at it. And then I realized it was just because I didn't understand what was happening on set every day. So put your pride aside. Don't pretend you know everything and just ask questions to make sure you're the very best host you can be.
Learn.
Yes.
Okay. One other thing I want to do. It's something that Mama RuPaul does from time to time on her show.
Uh-huh.
She holds up a picture. So I'm going to hold up a picture. Here's a picture of young Tan.
Yeah.
Circa age 7.
Yeah.
What would you say to that little Tan today?
That little Tan today, I would say, you continued crossing your legs as much as you want, young man, and don't let anybody tell you that you've got to butch it up.
That was Queer Eye's Tan France, speaking to Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna last year. And that's our show for today. Thanks for spending some of your Thanksgiving holiday weekend with Radio Boston. We have been so happy to welcome you to our table.